Wasn't that absolutely lovely? That was Jill O'Hara, going back to 1993, her debut album, her version of the Beatles, Here, There, and Everywhere. Well, the good news is that here, on Dave's Gone By, Jill O'Hara is not there or everywhere. She's here with us on the phone. Jill O'Hara, how are you doing?
I'm just fine, thank you.
Well, I'm going to have to turn up my headphones to hear you a little bit. If you could speak up just a little bit.
Sure.
Great. So,
Jill, you have just a lovely, lovely voice.
Thank you.
That was such a beautiful rendition.
Thank you. I think that's one of the most beautiful love songs ever written.
It is, and you did a great job with it. I love it.
So they just released that, re-released that debut CD, is that?
Yes.
Is that on what label?
That was on the Sterling Record label.
Uh-huh.
And now it's re-released on my own label.
Uh-huh.
Very simple, Jill O'Hara Music.
Now, here's a question that I guess anybody who's trying to compile stuff, especially in this day of the internet and all of that and the rights issues.
Yes.
Here you are covering all these different songs by these different and mostly very, very well-known artists. Was it an incredible pain in the butt to reissue this album as far as royalties and rights go?
No, actually it was simpler than I had realized, because once you get the, it's called the mechanical licenses, which is the right to release a recording.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's good for something like 20 years or 18 years.
Ooh.
You don't have to reapply for it. So I guess once it's done, it's very good. It holds for a long time.
Now, yeah. Do you owe, like, Lennon or whoever owns the Lennon and McCartney songs now? I think McCartney bought them back from Michael Jackson or something. But in other words, do you have to pay them anything once the album's out with royalties, or is that just radio stations' responsibility? Or how does that all work?
Well, for every... recording that's sold, there's a royalty that goes to the authors that the publishers collect for the composers.
Oh, nice.
And that's, I forget the exact term.
Mm-hmm.
One is called, I think, a performance royalty. I think that's what record stations pay for every airplay.
Right.
And for whatever recording is sold, there's another royalty.
Jill, I want to ask you about your experience on stage, because,
mm-hmm.
I mean, I love Promises, Promises. I'm honest to God. I think that's one of the most fantastic albums that's out there. I do like it.
Yeah.
And I love the little logo, and I like the with Jill O'Hara in there. It's so funny, because I could picture it in my mind's eye. So,
uh-huh.
Do you have any stories from that? Because that was, you also in George M?
Yes.
I mean...
Yeah.
Well, yeah, what are some really cool anecdotes of working on major Broadway musicals?
Well, you know, something that I think is pretty interesting about Promises is the way that the song I'll Never Fall in Love Again came about, which was...
Do tell.
In those days, I always traveled with my guitar. I used to sing in Greenwich Village coffee houses in the early 60s. And play the guitar.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter Tork, who later became one of the Monkees. Do you remember that group?
Sure.
Hey, we're
not
the
only, Monkees. Yeah, not only do we remember, Peter Tork has been a guest on this program two times. Oh, sure.
Oh, gosh. Well, I haven't seen him since the time when we were both singing in the village. But anyway, I was what my musician friends would now refer to really as a guitar owner instead of a guitar player, because I played so little. But I paid Peter Tork $5 to teach me a certain picking style on the guitar, which was really the only picking style I knew how to do. And we were all very young and very poor in those days, and I'm sure he was very happy to get the $5. And so when we were in out-of-town tryouts on Promises, we were in... Washington. We'd gone first to Boston and then to Washington, and then the next stop was New York. And the powers that be decided that they wanted to add a quiet song in the second act. And so I said, well, I play the guitar a little bit if that's something you want to use. And so Burt Bacharach sat down with me just to listen to me play the guitar. And then based on what he heard, he wrote I'll Never Fall in Love Again in 2 days.
Wow.
And about 2 days after that, it was in the show. I had to cram to learn it really fast because they wanted to try it out before the New York opening. And so I am playing the guitar, that little picking style on the on the recording as I did in the show.
Oh, wow.
Your $5 picking style.
Yes. But I just think it's very interesting because to this day I love singing the song. I think melodically, certainly, it's so beautiful. So it's just one of those tales of how things can happen in the theater.
That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
Do you have any memories of what it was like working with Neil Simon? Was he very involved, or did he step away once it was getting on its feet on stage?
Oh, no, he was very, very involved, and this is characteristic of him, not only with Promises, with every show he's ever done. You see it widely reported. He was constantly working, rewriting, making changes, right up until the last minute, and I think that has a lot to do with the success that he's had as well, his flexibility. I remember him once talking to me about another playwright who I won't name, who was extremely gifted and had a show open, a play in New York that wasn't successful. And Neil told me that this writer had a problem. He just would not change anything. Very, very rigid. So,
was it Herb Gardner or?
Stop it! Don't.
I don't want to say.
I'm not sure. I don't know. That was just a guess out of thin air.
It was
of a
joke.
A successful, smart playwright. No, I don't know Gardner's modus. It was just the first name that popped out at me.
Oh.
Let me ask. On George M.
Yes.
You worked with Joel Grey.
Was
he a diva or was he wonderful or somewhere in between?
He was wonderful, and he's still a good friend.
We're still in touch.
Yeah. Nice. And not only that, I got to do something very unusual with George M. Joel did a big summer tour. He revived the show, and he directed the production as well of George M.
Oh, okay.
And asked me to do the same role I had done 16 years earlier with him on Broadway.
Wow.
So you don't often get to do that.
No.
But I'll tell you something sort of fun about George M.
Yeah.
I was in Hair at the time, and Hair was at the Cheetah Discotheque because we were waiting for a Broadway theater to become available for the move.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, I auditioned for and got George M., which I was very interested in doing because I wasn't in Hair as a cause. I was a very serious actress, and what interested me about George M. was doing something so totally different. George M. Cohen's music and tap dancing, etc. And so I was rehearsing George M. during the day, tap dancing and singing those songs, and then at night I was in Hair wearing a button that said, "Let's get naked and smoke."
Were you one of did you?
Stop. Well, of course,
come on.
She got naked right before the intermission.
Oh, no, no.
No, some actors did and some didn't.
No, I left the show before it moved to the Broadway theater, and that's before the new director, Tom O'Horgan, came in. And actually, the whole show was changed very radically when he came in. He made it much more of a happening, kind of along the lines of a be-ins that were going on, if you remember that.
Yeah.
Songs that I did were cut from the show.
Wait, before you do that, I had one question.
After
hearing your voice and knowing that you did Hair, did you sing Frank Mills?
No, that was Shelley Plimpton.
Right.
And isn't that a jewel?
I love that.
That's my favorite. One of my favorites.
It's just because it popped into my head when you talk about the $5. I'm just thinking,
yeah.
I don't want my $3 back.
Just him.
That's brilliant. You know, actually, there is something that might be of interest to you. I had done a show, I think I was 18. It was my first musical in New York. No, actually, that was the second, and the first one bombed, too. But this one...
Which one was that?
Yeah.
That was called Royal Flush. There's an unfortunate title. And it starred Kay Ballard and Nikki Deems. And it closed out of town, and it was one of those real nightmares. We had three different directors, you know, along the way.
How was Kay Ballard to work with?
Oh, wonderful.
I hear she's really easy to work with.
Yeah. Oh, she was wonderful. But then I did this was an off-Broadway show called Hang Down Your Head and Die, and that one also, that closed the night it opened.
They're picking these titles that the critics can't resist, you know.
I know. And that was interesting, too, because Marion Javits produced it, who was...
Jacob Javits's
exactly.
Something?
Exactly.
What? Wife?
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. And she had a fortune teller governing everything.
Oh, God.
When we opened, etc. It didn't help. But in that show was Jerome Ragney and James Rado,
who
wrote Hair later, and that's where they met in doing that show.
So when you, what were the songs you were doing off Broadway at the you were at the Chico? Were you at the Public or not?
Yes, I was at the Public. Yes, the original.
So what were your songs in that context?
Well, Good Morning Starshine.
Oh, wow.
And I did a song called The Climax.
Oh, that's the very end of the when they re-released the Hair CD. They did the I wish I'd brought it in. They did a Broadway recording and the off-Broadway recording.
Yeah.
And The Climax ends the off-Broadway recording. Did it end the show, or did they still end with Hair, Let the Sunshine, and The Flesh Failures? well, that's what they called, you know, that's the title, yeah.
Oh, gee, I don't know. I don't remember whether it ended the show or not.
I mean, it's a good title for ending the show, The Climax. But
yeah.
I do it, you do it, we all do it. Look,
yeah.
So
well,
that was you.
Certainly late in the show, but I don't remember if it was the very last.
Have you seen the latest Hair revival?
No, but what I did do, I was invited as one of the original cast members. I guess it was a year ago, maybe two, I'm not sure. The Delacorte Theater in Central Park.
It was that summer.
Yeah, there was a 40th, and that's right, it would have been, it was a 40th anniversary celebration. It was a staged concert version of it that I went to see.
Yeah.
And I tell you, it just exploded off that stage. It was wild.
It's still amazing. I hope you get to see it because it's really a wonderful piece. It's become, rather than being that event that it was in the 60s, it became, and they added a book to it. And it becomes a period piece, which I love.
Yeah.
And it kind of reminds you about what happened in the 60s.
But don't say period piece. I mean, people hear the phrase period piece and they figure, oh, well, that's, you know, it's old. It has no vitality. We're just kind of visiting nostalgia.
Oh, God.
It's more than that. I've seen, they have tried over the years. Nobody mentions this, but they have tried over the past couple of decades, including original Rago Ragney. Or have tried to stage it off Broadway. They've tried to bring Hair back.
I know.
And every time they do these concert versions in these tiny theaters, and it's loud and it's a complete mess.
Well, that first revival at the Biltmore was terrible.
Mm. I didn't even see that one. I'm seeing little off Broadway things, and then the composer would show up and he'd wave, and he'd be real excited about it, but we all knew no. It was 3 hours and 15 minutes long, and nobody knew what the hell was going on.
Because in the 60s, it was an event. This was.
Well, you know, that's one of the things that I did not like about how it was redone, I mean, right after I left for the Broadway production.
Yeah.
Because they changed it radically. When I did it, it was much more conventional along musical theater terms in the sense that there were four main characters, and that's been restored more now, although not to the degree that it was in the original production. And then what they call the tribe functioned like a chorus does in a Broadway musical. But it gave you a chance to care about at least four people and what they were, what was going on.
Yeah, once they start, you know, centering on Claude, and you, whether he's going to be straight arrow or whether he's going to be hippie, and, you know, at least there's a story there.
Yeah,
and you can
exactly.
build from that, and then you've got Berger, who's kind of the mad, wild man on one side and his father on the other side, you know, these two polar things, it starts to really work.
Right, and the romantic attachments, everybody's in love with the wrong person. And
yes.
but the Hair, when you were doing it off-Broadway at the Public and then at the Cheetah Theater, were you
the Cheetah Lounge.
Embarrassed about the content, or were you young and hippie-ish yourself, and it was like, oh my God, I'm so glad there's theater that reflects what was really happening now and people's new consciousness and sexuality and all that?
No, I'll tell you, no, to me it was a job as a professional. And also, it was, you know, compared to the world that I had been in, singing in coffee houses, etc. I was living the real thing in many ways.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a theatrical version, theatricized version, if that's a word that I can use. So no, to me it was a job. And the music, I mean, when I was singing in the village, Bob Dylan was around singing. And
did you see him at Gerd's Coffee House or
Gertie's Folk City?
Folk City. You saw him?
Yeah. And I was working with, I was singing in the Café Wa for a long time. And
wow. Which is still around, by the way.
Yeah.
As a matter of fact, I don't mean to get, this is a complete side issue, but I might as well tell people because we're right at this stage here. I do a weekly cabaret panel. It's a cabaret style show where I talk to people in the theater and film industry. So it's a casting director, an actress. I invited you, but you haven't come on down yet, so we're going to have to get you down there to do it.
I'm sure she'll be there soon, David.
Well, it's at the Players Theater on 115 McDougal Street every Tuesday night at 7. So I went down to the bathroom the day before the show began, and I don't know, I went through went down the stairs, and if you turn right, you go towards the bathroom. If you look left and the door is open, I saw some guy setting up chairs in a big old, like, oaken, wooden sort of room with a stage. Uh-huh. And I looked on the walls, and it's like all these jazz people and stuff. I was like, oh, my God, it was the Café Wa. I just literally walked into or turned left into the Café Wa, and I was like, look at this guy cleaning the floor, and I'm like, didn't quite have the guts to walk in, but I was like, this is the place, man. This is it. So if you come down to everybody who's listening, if you come to the Stage Buddy Show, Stage Buddy Talk, on Tuesday nights at 7 to see me do my thing, then you can go to the bathroom and look at the Café Wa right after it's over or beforehand. Isn't that exciting, ladies and gentlemen, on McDougal Street Tuesday nights? But before we get back get to that, let's remind everyone, Matt. I'm Dave. I'm here with guest co-host Jeff Goodman, and we're talking with the lovely and extremely talented Jill O'Hara, who had the theater world on a string for a while. I mean, you had George M., Promises, Promises, both hits, not to mention Hair went on to some level of hugeness, and then you decided not to play the game anymore.
Well, actually, I've done many more plays than I have musicals.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
Many more. And I was a very serious actress. I was studying. I studied for 12 years with Uta Hagen whenever I wasn't working out of town somewhere. And as is very usual in the theater, I had a number of shows that were hoped to come into New York and didn't make it. You know, it's a very tough...
What are some of the plays that you were in?
Well, let's see. One was called Beck, and it was based on...
The Updike book? No.
It was based on John Updike's book, Beck.
Yeah.
And I played... I was the female lead in that, the Russian poetess Vera Glavinakova.
Okay.
That was one. I mean, I'm talking about the ones that were intended for New York.
Sure.
There was another thing that played in New York called The Party Girl that never went anywhere.
See, I was up for the lead in that. I did not get
girl?
It. Yeah.
Are you serious?
No, of course I'm not serious.
It's like you have no talent.
That's why I'm on this radio station. But, you know, Jill, but no, I had more of the impression from the website that you make a conscious decision not to stay in New York and not to go to Hollywood and do the film TV
well,
thing.
That's true. That's absolutely true. Definitely.
Were you offered anything
LA?
Famous?
Pardon?
Were you offered anything famous?
No.
Oh.
No.
Well, lie and tell people you were.
Yeah.
No.
I could have been Donna Reed.
No, absolutely.
Mary
I
Tyler
not.
Moore. Yeah, no. Okay.
I did not go to L.A. and do all that. That absolutely...
because you just felt that theater, regional theater, was your calling, that you couldn't do real acting on film or on TV?
Well, it's about the culture there and the values. I was there twice in 1 year on two national tours. I did a national tour of the musical Two Gentlemen of Verona.
Oh, yeah.
And in the same season, I was on the road 9 months that year. I did Gene Kerr's play, Finishing Touches. And with national tours, you go to major cities, and mm-hmm. you're there a good amount of time. I think in L.A. it was 6 weeks. And, of course, a lot of my friends moved there because I was right on the cusp of the business really changing. With so much moving to television and so many actors, most actors going out there to try to get work and mm-hmm. establish careers, and they often boasted, I've made more money in one day than I made in 6 months on Broadway, you know.
Of course.
But the values didn't interest me, the whole culture of the business didn't, and the work didn't.
Good for you.
I was much more interested in what I was doing, and once there was a Broadway play, excuse me, that I turned down because I was more interested in a regional theater. I was a production of the Hot L Baltimore that I did in Cincinnati. Mm. And I remember vividly buying the New York Times the morning after I knew this play was opening in New York and just praying I wasn't really going to regret it. And I didn't. The play was not a success. I didn't think it was good.
Hot L. Baltimore?
No, she was in Hot L. Baltimore. She chose to do Hot L. Baltimore, the Langford Wilson play. Do you remember can you say what the other play was?
Doesn't make a difference. It wasn't a success.
I don't remember the name of it. Arthur Sherman directed it. That's all I can remember.
Cool. So, it sounds like you made a decision and have not regretted it one bit.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, no. And good. Then after that, I got married, and my life really changed.
Yeah.
Who's your husband? How did you meet?
My husband is Philip Jones, who also produced both of those recordings with me. And I met him at a party where I purposely invited a gay friend to go with me in case I met a man I was really interested in. And that was, 25 years ago or so. I've never quite counted up. And
has your gay friend ever forgiven you for dropping him that evening?
No, and he was with me for the evening.
But you met Philip Jones.
Yes.
So that's and he's a music arranger? Is that his major?
No, he's just, he's an artist.
Oh.
And he's since become also an architect. When I met him, he was just painting.
Uh-huh.
Big modern paintings. And he's extremely astute musically. He played guitar himself, jazz guitar.
Cool.
And just has superb musical sensibility.
Just from talking to you, Jill, mm-hmm. I really think you are like a consummate artist at what you do, because you're so passionate about this stuff. I mean, I love the fact that someone will give up money for art.
Well, at least in the beginning, everybody gives up money for art.
No,
but if you pursue it, and you're on the cusp of making real money, and then turning that down and saying, no, you know, I can make a living decently and be happier making this choice.
But
I think that's very cool.
Also, these days, a lot of people go to Hollywood, big stars from Broadway, and they just can't make it. I mean, I know Faith Prince had a big problem before she finally got Spin City.
Uh-huh. Oh, well, look at Nathan Lane. He got a TV series after all the films. And I mean, he's a huge star, but he tried to do a sitcom. Didn't happen.
Well, that's because I mentioned, you know, there's a whole different culture there, a whole different value system.
Yeah.
And it's not necessarily about the work, you know. There's a whole other thing going on there.
Now, speaking of which, also, when we talk about the culture and competition, mm-hmm. how was it in the fact that your sister, Jenny O'Hara, mm-hmm. is also in the biz?
Well, that's been very difficult in the sense that there's a certain physical resemblance, and people tend to confuse us to the extent that a few years ago, having been given a Theatre World Award, I'm invited every year to the awards, and I went, and they always have photographers there that take pictures of people they know from the business. And so when I was leaving, these photographers had been snapping shots of me throughout the event, And as I was leaving, one of them said, "Well, goodbye, Jenny. Thank you." And I said, "It's Jill."
Oh.
But this was really something. They said, "What? What, Jill? What?" I said, no, I'm Jill." And they said, oh my God. They said, "Well, we're going to have to go back and correct all our records." They had changed their records. They thought that I had changed my name gone to Los Angeles.
Now, you and Jill are not twins. You're just sisters. How many years apart?
She's 5.5 years older than I am.
Wow.
And now, you just said you and Jill. See what I mean? And, you know, we actually don't look really alike at all if we're next to each other. But if you don't know us well, and then there's some confusion with the names. And
right,
then, of course,
yeah,
David Merrick hired her when I left the show.
So you both became theater actresses. He hired her for what? For Promises, Promises?
Yeah,
my gosh.
She replaced me, and I think he was trading on that, too. You know, the names are similar.
Sure.
So people
think that the original is still there.
Pardon? Yeah, exactly. So I think, I don't know.
Do you have any interesting things that happen during the run of a show?
Oh, my God.
I love hearing these stories,
yeah,
that's why.
It doesn't have to be one of the Broadway shows.
Do
it could be some regional.
Ever.
Oh, please, tell.
Well, I can't repeat the language that came out of my mouth.
Okay.
But again, in Cincinnati, I was doing Lanford Wilson's play, Serenading Louie.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a four-character play about two marriages that are in trouble, and it's quite a tragic play, and there were two things that happened that are in my my Hall of Fame. Of my experiences. Well, for one thing, it was the first matinee day, and this theater, we entered what my entrance was from the lobby into the theater, and they had the stage was kind of three-quarter thrust stage, but it was in the shape of, it wasn't elevated, really. We were on the same plane as the first rows in the theater. So I had to come in, and I knew there was a music cue. They were playing, and they said, "We'll serenade our Louis," and blah, 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 blah. So I knew I had a certain amount of music to get to my place on the sofa when the lights came up to begin the second act, and I was on for the entire second act once it came up. So I was so blinded, it was a bright, sunny day, and I hadn't experienced this at the rehearsal. And so I could not see. I couldn't even see the glow tape. I could see nothing. And I was running out of time. The music cue is going by.
Yeah.
And in the staging, there were two other characters were going to be seated on the couch as well. So I started to really, really panic. And then I finally reached what I thought was the actor.
Oh, no.
And I was crawling because I was literally blind, but I was cursing like a sailor, like a sailor. And I'm crawling across legs, and the lights come up, and I'm in the audience. In the Bible Belt, having just spewed profanity. That was one.
That is wonderful.
Well, it was, but then I had to try to keep a straight face. You know, I had to very politely remove myself from their laps, go on to the stage, and of course you can imagine the other actors too. They've seen me out crawling over the audience.
Where's Jill? Oh, she's in the audience.
And then at the end of that play, I mean, do you have time for me to tell you that?
Absolutely. Oh, yeah.
So I don't like loud noises. I'm better now, but
Dave,
I was
too.
Particularly. Oh, really?
Yeah, I think about gunshots in the theater. Yeah,
I can't take it. So in the play, the character that I played is murdered by her husband, and the audience has come to understand that, and there are gunshots. And so whenever the shots were going on in the rehearsal, I ran to another side of the building and held my ears.
That's exactly the kind of thing I would do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, until it was over. Now, we've been open for a while. I'm getting kind of cocky. I'm thinking, I'm going to go early to my curtain call. This is this is the ending of the play. So I had never seen the end of the play because I'd always been off holding my ears. Now, remember, the audience knows I've just been shot dead.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
So my entrance to the curtain call was from directly stage center, coming through a center door and coming in and bowing. So I'm early now this time because I'm cocky. So I'm standing back there holding my ears behind the door. To my horror, the door flies open. The play's still going on. The audience sees me in full view. I'm standing there holding my ears. And the actor playing my husband is flying through the door.
Oh, no.
So then I had to come out and take a curtain call.
And what did you have to do? What?
Well, then I come through and take my curtain call. But the audience, meanwhile, I'm supposed to be dead, and they've just seen me.
Before
the door opens to reveal me standing there holding my ears.
Because she hadn't seen the end of the play. Right,
exactly. No, I understand.
I get it.
I love that you turned the play into a ghost story at the very end. She comes back.
Now, my favorite thing, I am sorry. I pictured, as soon as you started telling that first story, I love the fact the lights are up and you're in the audience.
Oh, my God. Can you imagine?
Oh, I would have died.
Oh, actually, a friend of this is kind of, and this brings us back momentarily to the off-Broadway staging of Hair that you were in. A friend of mine from Milwaukee, who was in town to see the Drama Desk Awards, had questions for you. Because you know, she's very curious about Hair, and she just reviewed it when she was in town in New York to see some stuff. And she was curious about whether, as you said, O'Horgan changed a whole bunch of things.
Oh, a lot.
But in the part that you were in, when it was at the Public and at the Cheetah, was there audience interaction? Were people mussing people's hair and talking to the audience, going into at all? Or was there dancing on the stage at the end like they're doing now? Anything like that? I mean, dancing with, you know, audience members coming up and sort of dancing with the cast.
No, I don't remember anything like that with Cheetah. No. No, because what we did, it was transferred literally. No. No.
Okay.
No.
So do you have anything about Promises? A good story about Promises or
George
Broadway?
Yeah.
Well, I've told you really the best one.
Oh, yeah.
Well, those are pretty sensational.
That was a fantastic, fantastic story. I will never forget that, I don't think.
You know, I wish I could find Peter Tork. And
I can hook you up.
Can we have a reunion show?
Hmm. I'm glad you put you both on, because, Peter's been on the show twice.
Really?
Peter went through some stuff. In fact, unfortunately...
Yeah.
I mean, well, when we talked to him the first time, he went through all, you know, the conquering his alcoholism and all that kind of stuff.
I know nothing about what happened.
Yeah, but then since we've had him on, he had a tongue cancer scare.
Oh.
So that wasn't so high. I don't know how he's doing since that, but I hope he's doing all right.
Oh.
So we'd love to get him back on. And yeah, we'll be very happy to get you both on and talk to each other. And you can pay him back the $5 for the guitar lesson.
No, he could pay her back.
Well,
I think
it would be fun if he knew what happened, you know.
Well, then it worked, and that you ended up becoming responsible for a big hit song. Now, speaking of hit songs, and let's tell folks that they can hear the lovely music of Jenny,
Jill.
Because I have it on this piece of paper, that one question about Jenny, but I'm going to cross out that word there, so I'm not looking at it.
Okay.
Jill O'Hara's two albums, which are the Alone Together, that's the early, oh no, that's a later one, that's the most
actually,
recent.
Actually, the title is Jill O'Hara Alone Together.
Oh, the full title?
Yeah.
Okay.
The full title.
Without Jenny.
And her eponymous... I guess debut album going back to 1993 is simply called, well, it's eponymous, it's called Jill O'Hara. And the song composers on that one include everyone from Joe Raposo to Joni Mitchell, Harold Arlen. And do you have a certain kinship with Randy Newman? Because you do a lot of Randy Newman songs, especially on the new album.
Yeah.
What do you find in Randy Newman music particularly that suits you?
Well, I think he's a genius.
Well,
can you do me one favor?
Sure.
Can you tell Randy Newman to be a guest on the show? I would love to talk to Randy Newman.
Well, have
you would
ever,
love to talk to Randy Newman.
Have you ever approached him or his people, as they say?
I don't know.
Never occurred to me to even try, but I would, certainly.
Yeah.
I mean, do you know, are you friends? Do you know him, or do you just do his music?
I don't know him. No.
Oh, okay.
I don't. No, I think he writes.
He is so awesome.
He's
awesome.
So unique, original, and he writes beautiful, beautiful music.
Yes.
And I think a lot of people think that he's cynical, and I think he's actually extremely idealistic and really loves America, and that what he does really comes from that.
I think he's also truthful. He's a truth teller.
Oh, yeah. Well, on your new album, Alone Together, you do A Lover's Prayer, Roland, which we'll play at the end of the show, Dayton, Ohio, Marie, Old Man, Texas Girl at the Funeral, like six, half the album is Randy Newman, so that's kind of neat.
Yeah.
And you also do Fair and Tender Ladies, which I don't know, when you were going around the Village days, did you learn that one from Dave Van Ronk? Because he does that, oh my God. If you ever hear, not that your version isn't lovely, but in recent times I've come across Dave Van Ronk's version of that song.
Really?
And it's one of the most extraordinary performances
I've ever heard.
Because you know what Dave Van Ronk was like. He's this huge, burly, longshoreman type.
Yeah.
And a kind of a blues holler shouter for the most part. Mm-hmm. But he does this little folk song about a girl warning women that, you don't fall in love with men because men are bad. And, she gave her heart away and will never get it back. And she's just going to pine away for the rest of her life. And he does it in this high, it's not a falsetto, it's just this high voice. It's goosebumps.
I must hear it. Has he recorded it?
It goes back to one of his earliest albums, and then it was re-released on something that has not, I think, put on CD, called Christomathy, when he did a Greatest Hits package. But you can get it, on Rhapsody. You can download it. It's available. Check it out on the web. It's fantastic.
I'll tell you something about that song. I started singing that song when I was about 14 years old. I heard it on the radio or something.
Uh-huh.
And I always loved it because I think it's so pure.
Yes.
It's almost classical. And when I was doing that tour I mentioned with Joel Gray, when he did the revival of George N., I knew that songs like that were often sung by women alone, just to ease their own sorrows, a cappella, I mean, by Alone. And I had this wonderful old 1960 Dodge, and I was driving to the next big music tent we were going to. I think it was in Ohio somewhere. And I drove through the Appalachian Mountains, and I knew that song had originated, at least I had read that it had originated in the Appalachian Mountains. And there are different versions of it that were found all over the country. Anyway, I had such a visceral experience when I was going through that country. I could just feel that song coming right out of the earth. That's what it was like. And so I decided I wanted to sing it with just cello, just voice and cello, to try to capture that solitary aspect of it. And so I met with Byron Olson, the arranger who did a number of the arrangements and recording, and I told him what I wanted and what I wanted from the cello, to essentially be like another female voice commiserating. And he felt it ought to have a little piano as well. So he added some of that, and I think he did the most gorgeous arrangement. But a lot of it is just voice and cello. And the whole recording of A Jill O'Hara Alone Together is all acoustic, with bowed bass, cello, violin. And so that was extremely satisfying to me, to be able to fulfill that idea I had for the song. And also, I just think those musicians are out of this world.
Wow. That.
Well, how can people get a copy of either Alone Together or the Jill O'Hara album?
Well, I'm doing, for one thing, I'm doing a performance and a CD signing at the Lincoln Center Barnes & Noble in New York on June 3rd.
Mm-hmm.
And on my website, which is jilloharamusic.com, very simple, they can get it through the website. They can get signed copies through the website, and I must say everybody seems to want signed copies.
Well, yeah.
And it's also now on Amazon.com and iTunes. This is for both recordings, both for digital downloads.
Nice.
So there are
Let's just hear it. This is... Well, there's piano and cello, I guess. But here's Jill O'Hara.
We have to do a station ID.
Oh.
It's 12:03 Memorial Day Monday morning. We've been talking.
Happy Memorial Day.
Yeah, happy Memorial. Have you had a good? What have you done on this holiday weekend, Jill O'Hara? I got it right, and I still thought I was wrong. It's Jill O'Hara. Okay, I got it right.
Listen, I made a mistake. I should correct.
Uh huh.
You were asking where the CDs can be purchased.
Oh, yeah.
It's also on Rhapsody.com, which I had forgotten.
Oh, okay.
And those links on my website all go, you click on a little thingy and it goes right to Rhapsody or iTunes or Amazon.
Cool. Oh, that's good. And by the way, as I said, Rhapsody is the one place I was able to find that Dave Van Ronk version of Fair and Tender Lady. So just when you Google it, do that title and Rhapsody and Van Ronk, and it'll bring you right to a free download. You know, you can listen right there.
I will. Well, today I had a very, very long walk in the woods. I'm in Pennsylvania.
Oh.
We have a country place in Pennsylvania.
Nice.
And
where's your regular home? Where do you actually live?
Midtown, Manhattan.
Of course.
Where else, Dave?
What?
No, well, she does else? Regional. I didn't realize you stayed in New York.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Remember, she didn't want to go to California.
No, but I thought she went to the middle of the country just to do regional. I didn't realize you stayed on this coast.
No. No, I need my New York existence, too. Absolutely. But, you know, naturally, in the summer and stuff, I spend more time in the country, which I love. There's a lake here that I swim in. And,
right. Jill, do you have any desire to go back to do Broadway or off-Broadway or more shows? Because when was the last time you were on stage?
Well, not counting cabaret, which you come back to now and then.
Right.
Oh, do you mean
in a play
or
a musical?
I did a concert Monday night, but you mean
in a scripted
theater. Gosh, I don't know offhand.
Do you have a desire to come back and do that?
It depends on what it is. I tell you, I find this so satisfying with this last recording, especially.
Mm-hmm.
One, it's so it's very terrifying because it's so naked to just get up there and stand there and sing these things.
I know, and it's so funny because I must tell you, I feel very. It's so easy to talk to you. That's why I've always wanted to ask this, because I'm not a big fan of going to cabarets, because I find it a little dull for me to see one singer singing everything, and they're always very good,
but who cares?
No, it's not that, but but it's like I really just love hearing someone great in a story and, you know, singing in musical theater.
Oh,
I enjoy the whole performance of that kind of performance. Rather than the chit-chat. I mean, if anyone loves chit-chat, it's me.
Uh-huh.
No, but I see what you're saying. Like a 65-minute where it's really song banter is not the same as going to a book musical. Which it isn't. That's fair to say.
Because I would love to see you in a musical.
Well,
I don't know which one, though. I don't know what I'd put you in there.
Maybe something written by Craig Carnelia. I think she would do well with that kind of music.
Well, you know, when you say cabaret, I don't fit that definition at all. That's not what I do. I don't. I don't sing standards for the most part, or if I do, it's I don't know. I did Stormy Weather on the first one. That's based on a Mingus arrangement.
Mm-hmm.
10 Cents a Dance, which is on my new recording, I just think is a great song. I mean, I believe, was it Duke Ellington who said there are two kinds of music, good music and bad music? And that's the way I feel, too. Cabaret generally has a very, very strict definition. And it doesn't interest me. It really doesn't. It was a great place to try out my ideas, etc. But I don't do the usual sort of thing at all. And John Stone, who has since died, unfortunately, who created the Sesame Street and worked with the Muppets, I had done, centuries ago, I think I was about 17, I did a TV pilot with the Muppets of Cinderella.
Oh, wow.
And I was Cinderella, and Will McKenzie was Prince Charming, and I don't remember the name of the actress who played the wicked stepmother, but all the other characters were Muppets. And it was a pilot for ABC TV. Joe Raposa wrote the music. I still remember one of the songs that I sang. It was a beautiful song. And as a matter of fact, in finding out about getting the mechanical licenses, recording, I recorded Being Green, which I think is a great song.
Wow.
On the first CD. And so Joe died of cancer, unfortunately, and pursuing the licensing, I got in contact with Nick Raposo, his son, and we talked about the pilot. He remembered it, and I said I'd always wanted to see it. And the last I knew, I spoke with him not long ago, and he tracked it down. Disney Studios owned it.
Oh.
And he was going to get it and send me a copy. That's something I would really love to have. No, not yet. No. I haven't gotten it yet.
Maybe it'll show up on YouTube, too.
Come on, Nick. Let's get that in the mail.
Yeah. Or you can just post it, Nick, so we can all see it. Popping up on Vimeo or Blip TV. Anyway, it is 12:09 in the morning here on WGBB AM 1240. Want to let
and
you
also
know,
in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Everything east of, like, Ohio, I think, would still be the same time. We've had a wonderful chat with Jill O'Howe. She's just been absolutely delightful.
But wait, you didn't answer my question.
What was the question?
Going into a regular show.
Oh.
Well, I think it's clear that if the really, really the right thing came along.
Yeah, if it was really interesting material. There are some great musicals, but let me tell you, there's nothing worse than being stuck having to sing a bad song.
Oh, yes, okay.
Do you always, you were in flops, and I guess you sort of knew that they were flops when you were in them, but aren't there times when it could go either way and you really don't know until the critics have their say, on opening night, whether something sucks or whether it hit the mark?
Well, you don't know how it's going to be received, that's for sure. I must say, I think I'm pretty astute when it comes to judging material, and a lot of actors are not, I got to tell you. They just don't have that kind of a critical faculty. I know because I've been in productions with them, and they can be extremely talented, extremely good actors, but somehow they're just so subjectively involved that they don't see things that I often see in the material.
So you have an internal clock that will tell you, well, I took the job, I thought it might be okay, but this is going to close in a week.
But, I mean, look, I know when material is good, I'll tell you. That's for sure. But then there are a lot of things that can go wrong with the production itself.
Yeah.
For instance, I did a musical of I Remember Mama before the Broadway production, and it was meant to be headed for Broadway, big Broadway opening.
You did it with people who could sing, actually.
Pardon?
It was before Liv Ullmann came into the picture, right?
You did it with people who could sing, not Liv Ullmann.
Yeah. Well, this was Celeste Holm played Mama, and I played Katrin. And this was in the mid-1970s, if I recall correctly. And John Clifton was the composer, and wonderful music, wonderful stuff. But I think there was only maybe 3 weeks rehearsal. It was done at the Studio Arena Theater in Buffalo, which was a very, very well-known regional theater. And one of the best directors I've ever worked with, Warren Enters, directed it.
Who was that?
Warren Enters.
Oh, okay.
And they had the World Press review it. Well, in 3 weeks, all you have time for is just to see what you've got and then start working on it. And because it was subjected to all this pressure much too soon, it didn't go on from there. And it really deserved to. It truly, truly did. But because the reviews were instantaneously raved, it folded.
Right.
So all kinds of things can happen. I've been in other productions where there was another one that was eventually done. This is a play called Broadway that was done in the 20s. And we did it at the Berkshire Theater Festival. Gilda Radner was playing the lead, and Chris Sarandon, and William Atherton. And the director on that one just had a certain way of working that did not work well. Glenn Close was my understudy on that one.
Oh my gosh. So sometimes you can feel, I guess actors, most of them can feel it going wrong. Even the ones who select well initially can kind of, they have an internal clock that just says, you know, this is or isn't going to happen. But
and also another thing I've seen too, in the same lack of critical faculty to evaluate material and its worth, are actors who are extremely gifted but don't have a technical sense of acting technique.
Yeah.
It's really firmly grounded, so they're easily destroyed by a bad director.
They don't not no.
They don't have the technique to survive.
They don't have
director.
That respect for acting, right?
No, I wouldn't say that. No, I think they absolutely do.
Oh, okay.
They just, whatever their technical process is, it's not. Perhaps they're operating more intuitively, perhaps when they're working, rather than with any kind of specific technique. To survive a bad director, that's the best way I can put it. I've seen that happen a number of times, which is really unfortunate when you see a beautiful performance just start to be...
Okay, can you give another example? That's kind of...
No, then she's going to have to...
Of that?
Yeah. Well, it doesn't have to be involving you. It can be something that you've witnessed.
Well, I saw it with Gilda Radner
in
this production. I don't know what happened. I mean, she was brilliant. My mouth was hanging open. Whole rehearsal process, and as we got closer and closer and closer to the opening, she started circling the drain, as a friend of mine said.
Oh no!
I don't want to really be specific about.
Sure, sure.
I'm not interested in bad mouthing.
Because I happen to be reading right now started reading the new book by Arthur Lawrence. He wrote another little autobiography where he names names. He's Arthur Lawrence. He's 92 years old or whatever age he is, and he doesn't care. So if he has something good to say about Stephen Sondheim, he's got something rotten to say about Stephen Sondheim, or whoever, or Sam Mendes, whom he has a particular kind of loathing for.
Oh my God.
So, but you know, kind of in the end, it's okay to use the names because, when in the heat of battle. You want to be courteous, and you want to leave people's names out of things, because they're still working, and you can still run into them, and you don't want to hurt their families and stuff. But I guess as you get older and older and older, it's like, you say something bad about, I'm just throwing a name out, not that he does, but Ethel Merman, or you say something about Mary Martin or about Sarah Bernhardt. Well, who cares? Just say it. Why not?
Listen, I must tell you something. You both seem really genuinely interested in this. I hope I have this title right. I think it's Letters from an Actor, written by William Redfield. He was in Richard Burton's Hamlet, and he wrote a book. He was surreptitiously taking notes on what went on in the whole process, whole rehearsal process and the opening of the production. It's the most authentic account I have ever read of what really goes on.
Wow. What was his name? Redfield?
William Redfield.
I'm going to check that out.
It's called Letters from an Actor. I have it in New York. When I go back, I'll be back there in a couple of days. If I'm off at all on the title, I'll contact you and let you know. But I'm pretty sure it's out of print now, but it's so easy to find out of print books on the internet now. So easy. I bought about 10 copies.
Wow.
Just to give to friends.
Because I like books like that. I like Act One by Moss Hart. I mean, I just like those backstage books, even when they're not catty. If they're just seemingly honest. I mean, I read the Richard Rodgers autobiography and then was told that you have to take that with about 25 grains of salt. But there you go. Anyway, we have been having... I'm trying to think of a segue from grains of salt to... we're not having a spicy conversation with Jill O'Hara. We're having a... What is salt? Is a spice, isn't it? Or is
leave me out of this.
It's an element. We've been having an elemental conversation.
Salt is not an element.
Na, isn't it?
NaCl,
no.
Sodium and
sodium
chloride.
It's well, two elements.
We're having a bi-elemental
conversation with Jill O'Hara. Jill. So everybody, first of all, quick reminders. June 3rd, you're going to be at the Barnes & Noble at Lincoln Center in the evening, is it?
6 o'clock. And it's free to the public, which is marvelous.
But you have to but go buy the CD and you'll sign it. And
you can buy one if you want when you're there, and I'll be there to sign them. But
And you'll be singing a little bit, right?
Oh, yeah, I'll be singing. I'll be singing things from both recordings. It's a rather short performance, I think only half an hour or so.
Oh. But free concert, everybody, hey.
Yeah. I'll be with Bill Mays, who's my pianist in both recordings.
How come I'm not going to be in the country at that point?
Oh, Jeff will be out of town. Well, you'll have to videotape it and put it on on YouTube so Jeff can watch that.
I'm telling you, in the last hour or so, I fall in love with you and your voice.
Separately, unfortunately. It's a lovely voice, and you obviously have the adorable and lovely personality to go with it. You're just absolutely delightful. You didn't realize you've been on the air for an hour with us, and it's just gone by
really?
Like 20 minutes.
It's like it flew by. I looked. Well, that's when we went. It's midnight. I went, oh, my gosh.
Oh.
So, and we usually stop our guests at about midnight, but had no desire to...
We usually stop our guests at 11:30.
Well, so are we. No. We usually have actually pretty great guests every single week, and you are way up there,
Jill
O'Hara.
Oh, thank you very much. It's really been a pleasure.
So, likewise, best of luck to you. Best of luck in Pennsylvania and New York.
Thank you very much.
Have a good night.
Thank you. Bye-bye.